Started. Welcome to Narki Street. The Shabbat, it is, what is the date today? The 6th of October, 2018. And I see some new faces. We are doing a Bible study that's looking at a parasha, a section of text from the first five books of the Bible. And this section in the Torah, those books, is put together with a little portion from the prophets. This was done roughly, let's say, around Jesus' day already. People were putting these together. Today, there's a system that reads through the whole first five books once a year. And each of those portions has a place in the prophets connected to it. It's called the Torah and the Haftarah. And for those who don't speak Hebrew, please, Haftarah. It is not a half Torah. Totally different word if I spell it for you. Torah, half Torah. I'm putting block letters for those who need them. Lehaftir is to like separate. It's to it's like the dessert part. It's the finishing touches. So the Haftarah is the dessert, the Torah is the main meal. And the system today is divided differently, so the portions in the prophet are different. And so we've been going through slowly on this 3.5 year cycle, maybe what Jesus and his disciples would be doing, seeing what the connections are between this older system of reading. So today we are in Numbers 27, verse 15, to Numbers 28, verse 25. Verse 13 to 26 and verse 31. I suppose we could read through to verse 31. So I will open with some prayer. Lord, we thank you for a Shabbat to be together. Thank you for bringing each person here. Thank you for your grace that covers our weaknesses. I pray your spirit would be on each person, on me, on us, as we discuss your word that you've given us, that you'd bring to light and make it real for us, that we can understand more what it meant for them and what it means for us now. In Jesus' name I ask. Amen.
Amen.
So, let's read it together. Numbers 27, verse 15. If you can find that. Gemma, we usually, everyone just reads a portion. If you don't want to read, just tell the person next to you and they'll carry on.
Then Moses spoke to the Lord, saying, "Let the Lord, the God of the spirits of all flesh, set a man over the congregation, who may go out before them and go in before them, who may lead them out and bring them in, that the congregation of the Lord may not be like sheep which have no shepherd." And the Lord said to Moses, "Take Joshua, the son of Nun, with you, a man in whom is the Spirit, and lay your hand on him. Set him before Eleazar the priest and before all the congregation, and inaugurate him in their sight. And you shall give some of your authority to him, that all the congregation of the children of Israel may be obedient. He shall stand before Eleazar the priest, who shall inquire before the Lord for him by the judgment of the Urim. And at his word they shall go out, and at his word they shall come in, he and all the children of Israel with him, all the congregation."
So Moses did as the Lord commanded him. He took Joshua and set him before Eleazar the priest and before all the congregation. And he laid his hands on him and inaugurated him, just as the Lord commanded by the hand of Moses.
Adonai said to Moshe, "Give an order to the people of Israel. Tell them, you are to take care to offer me at the proper time the food presented to me as offerings made by fire, providing a male lambs in their first year and without defect, two daily as a regular burnt offering. Offer the one lamb in the morning and the other lamb at dusk, along with two quarts of fine flour as a grain offering, mixed with one quart of oil from pressed olives.
This is the regular burnt offering instituted at Mount Sinai as a pleasant, pleasing aroma, an offering made to glorify. The accompanying grain offering is to be a quarter of a hin of fermented grain with each lamb. Pour out the burnt offering to the Lord at the sanctuary. Prepare the second lamb at twilight, along with the same kind of grain offering and drink offering that you prepare in the morning. This is an offering made of fire, an aroma pleasant, pleasing to the Lord.
On Shabbat day, I make an offering of two lambs, a year old, without defect, together with its drink offering and a grain offering of 2/10 of an ephah of the finest flour mixed with olive oil. This is the burnt offering every Shabbat. In addition to the regular burnt offering and its drink offering. Proceed.
Sorry, just one second. But at the beginning of each of your months, you shall present a burnt offering to Yahweh. Two bulls and one lamb, seven male lambs, 1 year old without defect, and 3/10 of an ephah of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering for each bull, and 2/10 of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering for the one lamb, and 1/10 of an ephah of fine oil mixed with fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering for each lamb, for a burnt offering of a soothing aroma, an offering by fire to Yahweh.
The drink offering shall be half a hin of wine for a bull, and a third of a hin for a ram, and a fourth of a hin for a lamb. This is the burnt offering of each month throughout the months of the year. A one male goat for a sin offering to the Lord. It shall be offered with its drink offering in addition to the continuous burnt offering.
And in the first month, on the 14th day of month, is the Lord's Passover. In the 15th day of this month, there is to be a feast. For 7 days, let your food be unleavened cakes. On the first day, there is to be a holy meeting. You may do not serve of field work.
But you shall present an offering by fire, a burnt offering to the Lord, two bulls, one ram, and seven male lambs, 1 year old, without blemish. For their grain offering you shall offer fine flour mixed with oil, 3/10 of an ephah. For the bull and 2/10 for the ram, you shall offer 1/10 of an ephah for each of the seven male lambs, and one male goat as a sin offering to make atonement for you.
Yes.
You shall offer this besides the burnt offering of the morning, which is for a regular burnt offering. In the same way, you shall order daily, for 7 days, the food of a food offering with a pleasing aroma to the Lord. It shall be offered besides the regular burnt offering and its drink offering. And on the seventh day, you shall have a holy congregation. You shall not do any ordinary work.
Okay. Interesting division here of the parasha. What are the two themes in this portion? If you had to summarize the subject, what this covers. let's start in order. The first theme.
First thing is the calling of Joshua.
Calling of Joshua?
Well,
or
the anointing of Joshua or the commissioning of Joshua.
Let's say commissioning. How do I spell commission? One M?
Two M's?
Yes. Okay. And the next one?
Offerings.
The commissioning of Joshua, and then?
The offerings.
What about the offerings?
Shabbat, new moon.
The daily ones?
Okay, yes, the daily.
Or Rosh Chodesh.
Shabbat.
Weekly.
Monthly.
Yearly, but not the whole year.
No, Passover.
Until Passover. In our section.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so I was focusing more on the first part, but how did these two end up together? Why do the offerings start being enumerated here?
So that Joshua will understand or be sure of them.
Okay.
What struck me was the verse right at the beginning, this whole thing about going out and coming in. So
mm-hmm.
It's going into the... So they're going in, it's a man who knows how to go into the temple to worship, it meant the men to go out. And it follows on that the congregation may not be like sheep without a shepherd. In other words, this man's got to be a shepherd, he's really
mm-hmm.
got to know the ways of the Lord. He's got to know what it is to worship,
okay.
to offer sacrifices, and then to go out and lead his people.
So,
authority, yeah.
That's authority, there's some authority issues here, there's a lot of interesting themes here.
Yeah.
And Gemma's brought up some two words we're going to try to follow and see what do they mean in the Bible. So, the first one, let's make sure I'm going in order. Well, this is also interesting. The God of the spirits of all flesh. That's also a very interesting thing. My translation is humankind, but actually says all flesh here. You kind of think of all creation, all of living creatures. So,
is spirits, I've got spirits of all flesh.
Spirits?
Have you got it in plural?
Yes, yeah, so the spirits of all living creatures. So presumably the God, obviously God is one God who knows everything. The term we put with it maybe helps us think about what is being focused on in this selection. So here he's mentioned, instead of creator of heaven and earth, he's mentioned as the God of all spirits, the God of spirits of all creatures. So maybe the emphasis is more that he knows each person's spirit. I think spirit is a key word in this selection. So he knows every person's spirit. He knows every creature's spirit. To me, this kol basar is very big picture, universal, and it includes animals. But of course, we are focused more on the people because we are dealing with the community, the edah, the community of Israel. Now, this word is given to Moses, so of course, Moses is alive. But basically, he is here being told to commission someone to follow after him. So when he's no longer alive, there will be a competent leader. And he's told who that leader is. So before we get to Joshua, let's though do verse 17. This is how the leader is described. Who will go out before them and come in before them. Will bring them out and bring them back. And let not the community be like sheep who don't have a shepherd. Okay, so these are two metaphors here. to follow. The first is going out and coming in. And it's basically always in this order in the Bible, to go out, to come in. Latzet velavo. So what is latzet velavo? I'll just going out, coming in. It's a biblical idiom. So let's turn to the book of Joshua. Chapter 14, verse 11. Okay. Now this is actually Caleb speaking. Caleb, it's for you today. And he is telling, I guess he is talking to Joshua. And in verse 11, he says, "Today I'm still as strong as when Moses sent me out. I can fight and go about my daily activities with the same energy I had then." Okay, so I'm reading to you from the NET translation.
He's 85 years old.
He's 85, roughly.
And he's just as strong.
He's just as strong. Now, in verse 11, though, notice he says, "I can fight and go about my daily activities." Does anyone have a different translation there?
Well, simply for going here and there.
Going here and there, okay.
Just says, "I'm just as vigorous."
I'm just as vigorous after that.
"Go out to battle now as I was then," doesn't mention it daily.
Oh.
Still as strong today,
uh-huh.
But doesn't mention his activities.
Daily activities. Activities, you're right.
For war and for going out and coming in.
Okay, so there's the more literal translation. What translation is that?
Amplified.
Amplified, okay. Well, that's interesting. Amplified usually changes idioms, but here it's reflecting a more literal translation. Because that is what it says in Hebrew. It says, "My strength, my koach, my energy, then is like my energy now. For war, la milhama, latzet, to go out, velavo, to come in."
I'll just write it here. Can I just do a recap? This is Caleb speaking about himself, right?
Yes. You got some time. That's right. So then the question is, when you have an "and" connecting two things in the Bible, like heaven and earth, sometimes they're meant to be seen as one big chunk of the same thing. And sometimes they're two different thoughts joined together. So when he says, "My energy is the same," he says, "for war and for going out and for coming in," are those two things being equated, or are they different?
Different.
So in the NET Bible, they're translating them as different. I have the same energy for war and for my daily activities. So there's a contrast.
Yeah.
However, let's go look at some other contexts where they have going out and coming in. So 1 Samuel 18, verse 13 to 16. 1 Samuel 18, verses 13 to 16. Okay, here we are in the middle of the Saul-David story. David has been playing his instrument for Saul. And Saul, this is after the David and Goliath story. And in verse 13, or I'll say in verse 12, "Saul feared David because the Lord was with him, but had departed from Saul." So verse 13, "Saul removed David from his presence and made him a commanding officer," or an officer over 1,000, or an elef, whatever military unit that was. David led the army out to battle and back. So what do you think it says in Hebrew there?
I've got, and he went out and came in before the people.
That's right, and he went out and he came in before the people.
His goings and comings became public knowledge.
Interesting. His goings and comings became public knowledge. All right. Okay, so immediately preceding, we have he has just been appointed an officer in the army, and he went out and he came in before the people. So I would read this as describing his new position. He, to go out and to come in, is going to war and coming back from war. Publicly associated with the people. That's very, very interesting.
They're really grabbing at something.
Yeah, I think that kind of confuses things more. The way I would read this is, he became a commanding officer and he went to battle. To go out and to come back is an idiom that is oftentimes for military. You go out to war and you come back from war.
In different contexts, I still have this fixation about this going out and coming in. It's an idiom, but it also refers to you go out because you've already been in. It's to do with worship somehow. And if it's going to tie up with the parasha, it makes more sense as well for me, because it's a man who knows how to offer all these sacrifices.
Okay, so anytime you have an idiom, you can have a basic idiom.
Right.
And then you can have another level of meaning.
Right.
And another level of meaning.
So I'm playing with the double levels, all these levels.
Exactly. If you compare the work, the worship of the tabernacle, to military terms, you will find some similarities.
Right.
For one, what age do you be to serve in the temple?
20.
What age do you have to be to go to military? 20. So going out and coming in, I could see some similarities. But for sure, this idiom is found in portions of text that are dealing with military campaigns.
And in 1 Kings 3, Solomon says the same thing.
Yes. So let's go to 1 Kings 3. But what's your question?
In the original verses in Numbers, this version said that may go out before them and go in before them, who may lead them out and bring them in.
Yeah.
So it has like two separate things, saying go out and come in and then lead them out and lead them in. So I didn't know if that was... question is it really... are they just interpreting it like this? Or is it really in the Hebrew like saying it two different ways? Or were they trying to capture those two different things?
Were they trying to... I would see it more as emphasizing that they're leading the people out. Yeah, yeah. Like a commander that's leading by example. What were you saying?
For Gemma, it's like saying, let's charge the gates of heaven with this petition. That's first a military type imagery.
Yes.
So it's a metaphor in the sense of it being a prayer, but it's first and foremost
a prayer.
A military image.
So to charge the gates of heaven. Charge the gates is something that you would do in a military, and that metaphor then is used in spiritual language about asking in prayer for something very urgently. Yes.
The first initial meaning of it is first the military.
Yes. Yes. Okay. So let's look at 1 Kings 3:7. 1 Kings 3:7. Okay. This is Solomon speaking, and he's talking to God. Now, O Lord my God, you have made your servant king in my father David's place, even though I am only a young man and am inexperienced. Guess what it says in Hebrew? There you go. I don't know how to go out or come in.
Because I don't know how to lead.
Interesting. Yes. I don't know how to lead.
I do not know how to carry out my duties.
I do not know how to carry out my duties. So everyone is trying to explain the same phrase again. To go out, to come in. Just like we have another idiom, I don't know good and evil. And how do you understand that? And there are many interpretations of what it means to not know good and evil. So, and even in this text, we also have the same thing a few verses down of the different phrase I mentioned. Your servant stands among your chosen people. They are a great nation that is too numerous to count or number. So give your servant a discerning mind so he can make judicial decisions for your people, and distinguish right from wrong.
What verse?
I'm in verse 9.
All right. 1 Kings
3. In the same section, 1 Kings chapter 3, we began in verse 7, now I'm in verse 9. So Solomon is asking that he would understand between good and evil. Because no one is able to make judicial decisions for this great nation of yours. And in Hebrew, it's a rhetorical question. For who is able to judge this people, this heavy people of yours? And that takes us straight back to the Moses passage in Exodus 18 about Moses, it's being too heavy for him to judge the people. Okay, and of course, God really likes Solomon's response, and he does give him wisdom.
And then just to go on with my obsession, in verse 15, Solomon wakes from his dream, and indeed it's been a dream, and he comes to Jerusalem, stands before the Ark of the Covenant, and offers up burnt offerings. So the first thing that he does is to, as I read it, is to go in and worship and offer up these offerings.
Sure. So let's think about who these people are. In Saul's case, we have a background context that Saul is actually secretly trying to get rid of David.
Right.
And his strategy is to put him in battle.
Right.
And so he appoints him this commander of thousands, so that he goes to battle and dies.
And gets killed off.
And it specifically says that in chapter 18. So that's the going out and coming in to me in chapter 18, then it's clear that it's a military context.
Right.
Then we have, who is here in 1 Kings chapter 3? Who is this talking?
Solomon.
Who is Solomon?
He's the son of the king.
He's the son of the king. He's a king. Okay, so the first one we were talking about was David, and of course we know here he's just becoming a military officer, but eventually he's becoming king too. Solomon. Because I think part of the background understanding here is who Solomon is as king. What is a king supposed to do? And you have judgment of the people, going out and coming in, leading the people in battle. I mean, we know David, the reason people got behind him in chapter 18 was because he went out and came in. He led the people out to battle, came back again. So you can say it's a military expression. You can say it's not only a military expression, it's broader than that, maybe leadership in general. Because your leader takes you out to battle and comes back in again. But then specifically connecting it to kingship helps see the picture, because as king, you're also in charge of judgments, which connects us back to God's instruction. The king is supposed to know God's instruction, according to the book of Deuteronomy. And so that's also part of their responsibility. And that might also be what's behind commissioning Joshua and having all these offerings. Because later on, commissioning a king, where's Solomon in 1 Kings 3? Or, well, there he's in a dream, but right afterwards, what does he do? Verse 15, he went to Jerusalem, stood before the ark of the Lord's covenant, offered up burnt offerings, presented peace offerings, and held a feast for all his servants. So, the king is very much involved in, and certainly the ordination of a king is involved with offerings in the temple. Okay, so let's look at another passage. Second,
can I just ask something?
Sure.
Whether it's a diversion, which is completely wrong, but I never realized before that Saul sends David out to battle, hoping to kill him.
Yeah.
And David sends Uriah out to battle,
hoping
and
to kill him.
Kills him.
Yes. Same strategy.
Is that something turning back on his own head? I mean, in a way, it is in some way.
Only there's no turning back because David succeeds.
Yeah,
and Saul
David,
doesn't.
Yeah, but David's the one who ends up having to repent in big time
yes.
for it.
Yes. Yes.
It just suddenly occurred to me that was all.
Mm. Yep. It's a mafia technique. I don't know.
Yeah.
Shrewd.
Killing someone without.
Without killing someone, exactly. It's a way.
Brenda, what did you say?
I said sending them out to battle is a way of getting them killed without doing it yourself and let anybody know it.
That's right.
Yeah. It's very clean.
But with David, it did get exposed at the end.
Yeah.
Because there was a prophet involved.
Right. Yeah,
had there not been a prophet, no one would have seen, right?
Right.
Because Uriah's in the battle.
Knew.
Right.
Yeah.
So you think that David would.
He's trying to get away with it in secret.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But of course, there were plenty of people who would have known because the soldiers were given the instruction to pull.
Yeah,
back.
No. So that
so
the
people.
But only the high up commanders would know. The average soldier,
yeah,
you're told to pull back. You don't know that someone else is told something. Else, you know, you don't know why.
Yeah, come on, the backstreet gossip, and everybody knows. So there are many prophets.
Okay.
Sorry, sir.
So here, let's look at 2 Kings 11. Here, we have Jehoiada the priest, and he's organizing a conspiracy against the queen, Athaliah. Do you remember Athaliah? Athaliah allowed Baal worship. And she had tried to kill off all the descendants of the king before her, but she missed one that had been hidden. And so now he's being protected. And Jehoiada the priest is organizing things so that he will become king. And so it says, each of them took his men, those who were on duty during the Shabbat, as well as those who were off duty on the Shabbat, and they reported to Jehoiada the priest. The priest gave to the officers of the units of hundreds King David's spears and the shields that were kept in the Lord's temple. The royal bodyguard took their stations, each holding his weapon in his hand. They lined up from the south side of the temple to the north side and stood near the altar and the temple, surrounding the king. Jehoiada led out the king's son and placed on him the crown and the royal insignia. It says edut in Hebrew, testimony. Whatever that might be. It could even be a book of the law. They proclaimed him king and poured olive oil on his head. They clapped their hands and cried out, "Long live the king." Okay. Trying to see where my word is.
Who is he trying to make king? What was the name of the son?
Joash. Joash in English. Okay. What I'm not seeing is my... Yeah, oh, there it is. That's a problem when you're reading a translation. It just, like, takes it all away. Okay, verse 8. It says, "You must surround the king. Each of you must hold his weapon in his hand. Whoever approaches the ranks must be killed. And be with the king in his going out and in his coming in."
I thought that. You ought to be with the king as he goes out and as he comes in.
And here it says, wherever he goes. So it's an interesting usage here, going out and coming in. Is this, it seems like this is a commandment for right now, as this coup is taking place, you need to protect the king, this young little boy. But it could also be seen as, you know, you're going to guard this king everywhere he goes, like when he goes out for battle and comes home. And then it describes how they actually flanked him and did it. It's quite a dramatic little story. And Atalia is left saying, "Keshir Kashir." And then she gets killed.
It's very clear here, a military, whether it's...
Okay, so here it's political, right? It's something connected to the king. So again, we have Yehoash. He's a young king, and he's getting anointed. And this is close to the anointing. This is before, well, this is after his anointing, but before his becoming king. So you have a general picture of kingship. This phrase tends to come with kings, and also can come in military contexts. Certainly political ones. So, one more context. Let's look at 1 Kings 22:17. What am I doing here? So now we're in Ahav, the king Ahav's time. Ahab in English. Micaiah was the prophet. Remember, there were a bunch of prophets saying, yeah, you're going to be great, because he is trying to join with Jehoshaphat, king of Judah. So Micaiah says in verse 17, "I saw all Israel scattered on the mountains like sheep that have no shepherd." What does that remind you of? First Kings 22, verse 17. Numbers 27. Exactly. In the commissioning of Joshua, it says, "Let not the people of Israel be like sheep without a shepherd." And the inference is to a leader. And so later on in the Bible, all these contexts use the same image to refer oftentimes to the king. So here, when Micaiah says, "I saw all Israel scattered on the mountains like sheep that have no shepherd," then the Lord said, "They have no master. They should go home in peace." How does the king of Israel understand that? Look at verse 18. The king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, "Didn't I tell you he does not prophesy prosperity for me, but disaster?" So he immediately understood that. Sheep with no shepherd means, I see the nation with no king. So that means the king, he is the king. And if the prophet sees no king, he's going to die. He makes all those connections instantly. So a shepherd...
You're going too fast with me. So he's saying...
The prophet comes and gives a picture, right?
Right.
I see Israel like a bunch of sheep on the hill with no shepherd. The king turns to the other king and says, "See, he always prophesies bad things about me." So the king has understood that when he says there's no shepherd, it means he's going to die.
It's not that he's a bad king and that's why he's just
there is no king. There is no shepherd. In his mind means there is no king. I'm king. That means there will be no me. I die.
I mean, it could be like what Jim was saying too, though. It could have a double meaning.
In which way?
The present king is not really a good leader.
Yeah, you could say that too.
If you look at the Numbers 27 passage, it's also implying they need a leader who has been commissioned to do the job. Otherwise, they won't have any power or authority.
Yes. Yeah, you can, that he won't be a good king. However, it is in the context of a political, what do you call that? No, he's joining up with the king of the south to attack. No, it's a political strategy to whether to attack or not, right? And so the king puts him in prison. And he says, the king puts him in prison in verse 27, and he says, give him only a little bread and water until I safely return. Right? They're going out to battle. Micaiah is saying, you're going to die. So therefore, you shouldn't be going out to this battle. And the king is saying, put him in jail until I safely return, meaning I'm going out to battle, and I'm going to be fine, and I'm going to come back. And then Micaiah said, if you really do safely return, then the Lord has not spoken through me. And he says, take note, all you people. Okay.
He does get killed.
Right. So we know Micaiah was speaking the word of the Lord.
And I'm just looking back at the Numbers 27 passage, that it just seemed to imply that they need a leader. So it's kind
yes.
of a broader idea whether a leader is missing or there's not a good leader. It's you need a good leader.
Yeah. Yeah, it's both together. And the connection, if you look at verse 20, there's also the connection of the spiritual side. Because after the king says, look, you know, this guy's always prophesying against me, then Micaiah adds on, and he says, all right, you want more? Here it comes. That being the case, hear the word of the Lord. I saw the Lord sitting on his throne with all the heavenly assembly standing on his right and on his left. The Lord said, who will deceive Ahav so he will attack Ramoth Gilead and die there? So here, instead of Saul or King David using this military strategy to get rid of someone, it's God. God says, who can lead him out so he dies? It's a little bit ironic because he's giving this word as a warning. Like, this is what's actually happening. If you go out and fight, you're going to die. And then a spirit. Okay? Vayetze ha-ruach. In Hebrew it says, the spirit went out. Doesn't say the spirit of who or of what, but some spirit went out and stood before God and said, I'll deceive him. The Lord asked him, how? He replied, I will go out and be a lying spirit in the mouths of all his prophets.
Does that tie up with the spirit?
Ruach sheker. Yes, the Lord of all spirits. I think it does. Even though this isn't, we're following this one phrase to go out and to come in all the different contexts, and it actually seems to line up with a Numbers 27 context.
Isaiah 40, you don't have
it? Not yet, we're getting there.
Okay,
yeah.
Because the very first verse, in verse 13,
is the spirit, exactly. So the lying spirit in the mouth of all his prophets, these were, what weren't they, like 400 prophets or something? Everybody else but Micaiah is basically telling the king, yes, go out and fight and you'll be fine. But the Lord has decreed disaster for you. And then Tzidkiah, another prophet or someone came up and hit him on the jaw and said, which way did the Lord's spirit go when he went from me to speak to you? And then Micaiah said, look, you will see in the day when you go into an inner room to hide. Okay, so he's getting made fun of by all the other prophets. So the interesting thing is, so the king, or the leader here, because this is before there's an actual kingdom, it describes, though, Joshua's commissioning as a sort of coronation. If you look at future coronations, they kind of use some of these same themes. So part of the commissioning involves going before the temple, and specifically the Urim. Do you remember Urim and Tumim?
Yeah.
This was a way of inquiring of the Lord. So when does a king inquire of the Lord? Happens all the time with David. When? In what context?
Going to battle.
Should I fight these people or not? And you inquire of the Lord, and we don't know exactly how the system worked, but somehow we know that when Saul inquired, he didn't get an answer. So there must have been a tie where there's no answer. There's a yes, there's a no, and there's a nothing answer. And so the king would go. So the priest is involved, because the priest is the one that holds these Urim and Tumim. Here, I think it's only mentioned Urim back in our base text. And so, here we have a picture in 1 Kings 22 of a king going to inquire of the Lord whether to go out for battle. And we don't have mention of the Urim, but we have mention of all these prophets telling the king what to do, whether he should go or not. And so a bunch of prophets have a false spirit, a spirit of lie. And then Micaiah gives a true prophecy that the king doesn't want to hear. And so he goes
so
to battle and dies.
With the difference between good and evil. Because if a whole bunch of prophets all have a lying spirit, which is what this says,
mm-hmm.
and there's a whole bunch of them, I mean, the arguments in the world...
You need discernment, right?
Yeah,
you need
discernment. In the world we say, yeah, but look how many people teach something.
Yeah, yeah.
And you don't... You need a discernment to know...
You need discernment to know which spirit to listen to, basically. Which advice...
What First John says.
Maybe it doesn't mean that Ahab, the king of the northern king, has already decided exactly who will go.
Yeah.
He's decided. He just,
Yeah.
He's been organized by his wife.
And most likely, that's why all the prophets tell him, go.
Yeah, because they're the safe side.
Because they're interested in keeping their head on their shoulders. Because Ahab, he's not a great king.
He must have been worried about to disguise himself, mustn't he?
Well, he thinks he can get around it by disguising himself.
He didn't get around, but...
But,
he must have thought perhaps what he's telling me just might be true.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm jumping the gun, but this whole thing about sheep without a shepherd...
Mm-hmm. So just to before you go there, where did we see that sheep without a shepherd? What are the two passages?
Numbers
27 and... 1 Kings 22:17, the one we just read about Ahab.
Yeah. And also in Ezekiel, right?
In Ezekiel 34, it is too. Which
So a people without a shepherd means they haven't got a king.
Yes,
basically.
Correct.
So if we come to the Yeshua talking, and he also, I don't know if he actually uses that expression, does he say you're a people without a... saying he's a good shepherd or...
He's compared to a shepherd. So what is a shepherd? A king.
A king.
Yeah.
Shepherd king.
Or a leader. He's often pictured as a leader.
But it ties up to the whole, really.
Yeah. Well, leader, like I said, in Joshua's day, you could say Joshua was king in some way. He's a leader. They didn't have a kingdom, we don't call them a king, but in essence, that was their position.
Right.
That was Moses' position. So... leader, king, however you want to call it. And then your shepherd is that person.
And then the Ezekiel chapter about false shepherds.
Uh-huh.
Which he comes back to the lying spirits again.
Wait, you want to, in Ezekiel...
I think it's 34.
Yeah, Ezekiel 34. Okay, so... we'll go to Ezekiel 34. Son of man, prophesy on the shepherds of Israel. Okay. This is what the Sovereign Lord says. Woe to the shepherds of Israel who have been feeding themselves. Should not shepherds feed the flock? You eat the fat, you clothe yourselves with the wool, you slaughter the choice animals, but you do not feed the sheep. You have not strengthened the weak, healed the sick, bandaged the injured, brought back the strays, or sought the lost. But with force and harshness you have ruled over them. They were scattered because they had no shepherd, and they became food for every wild beast. My sheep wandered all over the mountains and on every high hill. My sheep were scattered over the entire face of the earth with no one looking or searching for them. So, definitely, he's speaking to the leaders here, to the kings, and he's calling them shepherds.
Zechariah 13:7 says, strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered. And then that's quoted in Matthew 26:31 when Jesus told them, this very night you will fall away on account of me, for mm-hmm. I will strike the shepherd and the sheep of the flock will be scattered.
Matthew what, right?
Matthew 26:31. So, that whole idea is coming out of Numbers
27. We all talk about Messiah in English. What is that? Where is that imagery coming from?
The anointed king.
It's the anointed one.
A king.
And in Hebrew, you don't just say Mashiach. You can shorten it to Mashiach. You say Melech Mashiach. The king anointed. So, Jesus' role as Messiah, as King, as a true leader, it's going to be using all these metaphors, which are in the world of kingship. In the Ezekiel passage, since we're there, what is the role of a shepherd, of this king?
Protect
who? The weak. Feed all the sheep, but look specifically, verse 4, strengthen the weak. It's to help the people on the outside fringe who are vulnerable.
Verse 4
of Ezekiel 34.
Because in Matthew 9:36, it says when Jesus saw the crowds, he had compassion on them because they were harassed and hopeless, like
mm-hmm.
sheep without a shepherd.
Exactly. So I think Matthew is trying to hint to Ezekiel 34 here.
Oh, more than that.
I would say stronger. I was going to say.
He's alluding to.
Yeah, but I think it's so important because so often people read New Testament scriptures and have no clue about really where it's coming from. Because
yeah.
it's much stronger in the Hebrew text.
Yeah, yeah.
And then Jesus takes one line. And, you know, I've got 3 pages of notes about where
and
it comes
with
from.
With that one line, he can refer back to all this concept of kingship and what the proper king should be doing, what his identity is. Absolutely.
It goes over our heads.
Yeah.
Yes.
I read a thing this morning. It says, not understanding the Hebrew is like a groom kissing his wife through a veil.
There you go.
You're not giving the real thing.
That's right. It is interesting when you think of Jesus talking to Peter. Remember this? And he says, Peter, do you love me? You know I love you. Feed my sheep. So I know many sermons are preached on this. But right here, his word against the kings is, you're not feeding the sheep. So to feed the sheep is to be a good leader, a good king.
Yeah.
And so in a sense, who is the first leader of the church in some ways? Peter. He's got, you know, keys, and on this rock, alluding to his name Petros, on this rock I'm going to build my church. So he's set up as kind of being a leader of the church. And Jesus can do that with the metaphor, feed my sheep. Who feeds the sheep? A shepherd. Who is a shepherd? A leader, a king. And God's building his kingdom on Peter. So that's kind of a nice little thing. thing there too you could follow up on.
So just quickly to add to Gemma's point about kissing, groom kissing the bride.
I'm just giving you ideas.
Yes. Mm-hmm. No, but it says that today when the Jewish people are reading the Torah, it says that the veil is still on their face.
They're kissing through the veil.
Some of us have the veil off.
I like that. Yeah, there are other contexts that this appears in. I think if we read all of them, it would come clear that it is definitely a context used for battle and for kings and for leadership, because they're the ones that take the people out in battle. If they're not the commander themselves, then they're at least conceptually the person leading them out to battle.
So my question is, at the time, what's your...
Yeah, so Isaiah 40... Verse 13. Who comprehends the mind of the Lord? And in Hebrew it says, Ruach. Ruach Adonai, which is the spirit. Spirit of Adonai. Or gives him instruction as his counselor. For whom does he receive directions? Like, who helps him understand? Who teaches him in the ways of justice? Or imparts knowledge to him, or instructs him in skillful design. Look, the nations are like a drop in a bucket. They are regarded as dust on the scales. He lifts the coastlands as if they were dust. Not even Lebanon could supply enough firewood for a sacrifice. Its wild animals would not provide enough burnt offerings. All the nations are insignificant before him. They are regarded as absolutely nothing. To whom can you compare God? To what image can you liken him? A craftsman casts an idol. A metalsmith overlays it with gold and forges silver chains for it. To make a contribution, one selects wood that will not rot. He then seeks a skilled craftsman to make an idol that will not fall over. Do you not know? Do you not hear? Has it not been told to you since the very beginning? Have you not understood from the time the earth's foundations were made? He is the one who sits on the earth's horizon. Its inhabitants are like grasshoppers before him. He is the one who stretches out the sky like a thin curtain and spreads it out like a pitched tent. Okay, it goes on. Oh yeah, we can go to 26. He spreads it out like a... Oh yeah. He is the one who reduces rulers to nothing. He makes the earth's leaders insignificant. Let's see. That's Rosnim in Shoftei Aretz. Indeed, they are barely planted. Yes, they are barely sown. Yes, they barely take root in the earth, and then he blows on them, causing them to dry up, and the wind carries them away like straw. To whom can you compare me? Whom do I resemble, says the Holy One? Look up at the sky. Who created all these heavenly lights? He is the one who leads out their ranks. Uh-huh.
Brings out.
Hamotzi v'mispar tzva'am lechulam. He brings them out. Here I have, he leads them out in their ranks. He calls them all by name. Because of his absolute power and awesome strength, not one of them is missing.
Wow.
Which part are you wowing?
Ne'eda.
Yeah, yeah.
And the parable of the lost sheep.
The parable of the lost sheep,
yeah.
Which the critique in Ezekiel was that you're not going after the lost sheep.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. Here his absolute power is the one that keeps them from being missing.
So when it says...
He leads them out like sheep.
So he leads them out. It doesn't mention sheep here, but he leads them out in their ranks. It does use the same military... title for God, who is pictured here as king not only of Israel but of the whole world.
Leading out the sheep.
Yes. And it ties it to creation too, and to the spirit. And it's interesting, the connection, he's comparing himself, who is a proper king, to idols who are nothing. And it goes, so it kind of contrasts proper worship with idolatry. And here, the coronation of the king is then connected to all these offerings that are commanded to do in the proper way, and not idolatry. So that's another interesting connection. This connection between kingship and worship. Because in our world, they're kind of separated. But here in the Bible, they're separated but connected. There's a king, but he's supposed to follow proper worship. And proper worship is part of what keeps him in his place. He goes to the priest to receive his position. And he goes to the priest to inquire of the Lord before going out to battle and all of
this. So that ties up with the whole of the second half of the parashah, which is about the sacrifices that have to be brought.
Right, that's what I'm trying to say, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Does anyone see another connection between these passages?
Well, I see that there's a common theme of the priest king. We have the creation of Adam.
Uh-huh.
He's supposed to have dominion over all the animals and
dominate
them, but he's also supposed to keep dominion, the shmoy, the garden. So you have that, the perfect man, but he uses free will to sin against God. Then the second man
perfect, I'll just say perfect human. If you're going to quote chapter 1, it specifically mentions humankind should be rulers over the earth. Yeah, and you have very much the kingdom idea there. And them being commissioned by God. And that's interesting you bring that connection up, because in creation, he says, I'm going to create man in our image. It literally says. Image, the word tselem. We had a Bible study here years ago. What is tselem in other contexts? Idol. It's an idol. It's an idol.
What is?
Tselem. Tselem.
Oh, Tselem.
Tselem is an idol.
I think it's Tselem.
No, Tselem. So, when God makes image, you know, he says, take down your images, your foreign gods. So, instead of having a god of stone, God is saying, humans are going to be my image. They're going to be little walking around representations of me. So, when he's commissioning humans to rule the world, he's saying, you're going to be, I want you to be like me, so the whole world can see what I want to do. And so he's really making each little human his own idol. So you have that connection to idolatry, where the problem with idolatry is not just that you're going against God and worshiping the wrong way, but you're actually denying who you were meant to be, because you were meant to represent God in the way that other people use idols to represent God. So there's a double problem there. You're denying your own identity and the way God set it up, that you would reflect him. And then, you were mentioning connection to Jesus as the second Adam and the kingship and all of that. Absolutely. There's a whole lot more in these passages that we have time to go into. But thank you for that. We can continue these themes as we go along this morning. I didn't even get to Hod, but I was thinking a lot about Hod. It came in, was it the Joshua? Hod, yeah.
What's Hod?
God tells Moses, give some of your Hod to Joshua. And we sing a lot of songs about Hod v'Hadar. It's like glory. But it's also, there's a sense, it's majesty. It's not just glory, it actually has a status. It's like authority as well. It's like this awesome big thing. And so it's interesting because Hod only comes about 25 times in the Bible. And you could easily do a study on that. But again, this connects us, if we're thinking about kingship, and Moses as sort of king has this Hod. He has a glory given to him by God and an authority. Glory and authority being combined in this word, Hod. And he's supposed to give some of that onto Joshua, so that the people will respect Joshua then with the same authority as they respected Moses. So, yeah.
I noticed when we were back in Ezekiel 34, I think it was verse 6, that as you read down there, it actually mentions that if he didn't feed the sheep and that stuff, that they would start wandering among the mountains and the high hills, which to me is
idolatry.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Stuff, it's really because the king isn't shepherding them, them, keeping them, that he actually causes them to go out and rebel and do the opposite.
Yeah, because part of the king's job is to ensure that the people know the proper way to worship. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You have one more comment?
Yeah, I was thinking like the going out, coming in. I'm seeing a double meaning.
Yes, leading. Let's say leading in general.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Because as we said, some of these military terms are also used in the temple and the tabernacle. So the common thing they all have is leading, leadership of the people. And definitely there is a spiritual leadership and a political leadership. The political leader is also meant to be under spiritual leadership and to be the right spirit and to be discerning and to make good decisions and to instruct or to set up laws so that the people do the right thing as well. All of those are combined. Okay, so we're out of time this morning. Shabbat shalom.
Shabbat shalom.